Is this a fucking dream?
Oh my God.
My God. Oh my I don't God. Even care if this ever goes live.
Oh my God.
Like, that oh my God. My life is made.
Oh my God.
That was oh my fantastic. God.
That was amazing.
Oh my God.
I love him so much.
Like, I didn't know it was possible for me to love Khalid Al-Amin more, and yet I do.
Right?
Hey everybody, welcome to the Dimebag Podcast. I am Tyler Wilkinson, and joined today by Megan Barr.
Hello!
And Russ Steinberg.
Hello!
And our producer, Alex Cohen.
Hello, hello.
And as always, the Dimebag Podcast is brought to you by J. Timothy's Tavern in Plainville, Connecticut, where the entire place is made of chicken bones, and inside you eat chicken meat. It's weird, but it's great. It's awesome.
That's a thing.
So this is a very special episode of the Dimebag Podcast, because you're about to hear our interview.
Drum roll! With
UConn legend, national champion, all-around badass dude, CBS commentator, Khalid Al-Amin was on the podcast. And you're going to hear us talk to him.
Oh.
It was pretty cool. We literally awesome. Just finished recording, and we're all pretty just buzzed off talking to Khalid. Like, it was that fun.
It was amazing.
I don't know whether it's entertaining for the people who actually hear it now, but it was,
you know what? I don't care.
Pretty great for us doing it.
I don't care if they find it
that's true. It was for us.
Yeah.
It was for us.
Yeah,
it's not for you. It's not for you.
So we had some technical difficulties, so it might jump in mid question.
We trust you'll figure it out.
It'll still be well worth your time. He's great. He's incredibly insightful. And like, Tony Hansen's name got dropped. Like,
I know. Yeah. I had the same reaction.
And he's so confident. I love it how confident he is.
He's a lot of talk about what you didn't know he would be that confident.
No, I knew he was. I knew. No. Like, I know he's confident on the basketball court. I didn't know that, like, in general conversation, he backs himself like that.
Yeah.
That's awesome. He was
Khalid
awesome.
Al-Amin, the person, is Khalid Al-Amin, the basketball player.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
It's so cool.
All right, so you're about to hear it. Enjoy the pod, everybody. So I was thinking to you the other day, we actually, last episode on our podcast, we talked to Gabby Williams, who's a women's player at UConn who's just overseas. And it was making me think about you because you were really the first UConn guy I can remember. You know, all of us on the podcast here have been on UConn fans for decades, but you're the first one I can really remember that embraced going overseas and like had a hell of a career doing it. I mean, what was life like being across the world for so much of your career?
Wow, man. I've been the first at UConn for a lot of things. Wow.
Man. Sure have. Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
You just hit a sensitive spot. No, but yeah, I mean, it was something that I think that I had to do, to be honest. You know, I played a couple years in the NBA, you know, I played with the Bulls, and then I got on with the Dallas Mavericks, and unfortunately, things didn't work out for the long haul. For those teams, but I still wanted to play. I still had, you know, a big motor. I still had the love for the game, the desire to play. So, you know, going overseas, my agent presented it to me, and, you know, I was used to being alone, and I've been doing it since high school, going out to New York, playing with the New York Gauchos and the Long Island Panthers, playing with Lamar Odom, staying at his home. summertime. So I was always away. So I was comfortable with that. And having to do that to earn a living, you know, hey, my parents always tell me you have an opportunity to make some money playing basketball. So it was a no brainer for me to go over there and, you know, just play the type of game that I wanted to play. And I'm just grateful that it worked out.
I think you're selling yourself short, though, too, because, I mean, you were, by all accounts, like a really amazing player overseas. I mean, for a long time, like, you were the American name that, you know, was referenced a lot as like the guys that came over and just started destroying, you know, the international leagues.
Well, that's the mentality that I had. I thought of myself as an NBA player, but, you know, when I had to humble myself and go overseas, I said, I'm going to let everybody know who Khalid Al-Amin really is, and I'm going to prove that I belong in the NBA. And so I did play with a chip on my shoulder overseas. And yes, I had a great career. I'm not trying to downplay it by any stretch of the means. I played 16 seasons, and you know, won multiple championships, multiple MVPs. So, yes, I'm very happy with my success in Europe. And, you know, I would only trade that for a multi-million dollar contract. but I definitely love the experience that I got. I got to travel the world playing basketball, you know, and I've seen great countries. I played in France for 2 years. I played in Turkey for 4.5, 5 years. I played in Ukraine for 3 years. I played in Croatia. I played in Lithuania. I played so many places and got to see Europe. And you know, I'm blessed. And so I just know that it took a lot of hard work, and dedication, and a lot of time by myself, getting to know myself, getting to love myself, and you know, sometimes I had my family come over, so that made it even more special. But the opportunity to play basketball for a living, you can't trade that and take that for granted. It is something that only a few have the opportunity to do.
So,
go ahead, Russ.
Just you were listing off all the places that you played. Just curious, how many languages do you speak now?
Well, I'm going to be honest. I'm not fluent. I'm not fluent in any one language, but I know enough Turkish. I know enough Russian to get around. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, but my experience there was phenomenal. You know, playing in Turkey and just embracing culture and having the culture embrace me. And of course it is a Muslim country, so you know, we have that mm-hmm. common bond and ground there. But the food there, the culture, how they respect their elders, how the hospitality that you are shown when you go to a someone's house is just so it's just great, and it makes you appreciate everything, you know, that I experienced in Turkey, and especially even when I go to playing in the Ukraine, they were just tremendous, hardworking people. You know, they love their children, and I just remember, you know, just saying, "Wow, you know, I really am blessed, and I really have the opportunity to enjoy these cities." And you know, luckily my family was there, so it was just a win-win for me.
So it's kind of something that we've talked on this podcast a lot about with various players over the last few years where, you know, maybe they're not going to have a career in the NBA, but they have the opportunity to go overseas, maybe leaving college early, maybe staying through their senior year. But if there are players now who aren't going to have long careers in the NBA who want to go play overseas, what sort of advice would you give them to take out of that experience?
Yeah, and first of all, it's okay to have a long NBA career or for you to have to go overseas. You know, it's okay. I mean, let's get it understood. The NBA are the best players in the world, you know? So, you know, for you to have to go overseas and make a living, and you can make a great living over there. So I would encourage anybody who has the opportunity to take it on. You know, you get to see other parts of the world. You appreciate America. You get to appreciate the where you are and your situation here at home. And like I said, you have an opportunity to take care of your family. And Why not play basketball for a living? Why not make that, you know, your job? You know, that's a great job to have. You love it. And if it's something that you love to do, then it wouldn't even be work. So I encourage anyone who has the opportunity to go overseas to please do it. Experience that type of basketball there is going to make you a better basketball player, you know, in your endeavors to make it in the NBA.
Did you find that, I mean, at the time when you were doing it, obviously, I feel like it was not as well publicized, but did you find that there was like a stigma for coming back? Like, did you ever try to like catch on with an NBA team that was sort of, I guess, put off by the international play?
I think at that time they were just embracing that, actually.
Right.
You know, the game was global then. You know, you had guys from overseas playing. It wasn't as many as it is now, of course, but you had a few. And you could tell that, you know, the overseas game was coming. You know, you can, you know, their players, they were in basketball schools, the young players, you know, in basketball schools at young ages and getting good coaching and just learning the game. And I just think that the big difference from international ball that I took away was it feels like it's more of a team game in Europe. Like, sometimes guys would come over in Americans, and it doesn't matter who you were. You could have been American and you could have been a local player, and you score 40 points, right? But if your team didn't win, people will forget that. It's not like now, like, you know, in the NBA, you know, and it's no knock on James Harden or anyone who scores 50, 60 points. But if you do that and you don't win, you know, it's kind of, like I said, you kind of, it's forgotten. And if a guy had 10 points and or 3 points and 6 points and you get the W, that was celebrated more. The win was more celebrated than, you know, somebody's terrific individual outing. So that's what I took away from European basketball and the culture there. But, yeah, man, it's definitely something that one has to experience to appreciate.
So to the subject that, you know, we're all super curious about is your time at UConn. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just, UConn just announced it's the 20th anniversary of the 99 championship.
No!
They're going to do a celebration. I mean,
wow.
Is it wild to you that you were playing college 20 years ago and they're still celebrating your game?
And it is wild. And the reason why it is so wild for me and it's just so surreal and everything is because I have a baby that's a sophomore in college now, you know.
Right.
I won it. So everything that he's going through, of course, you live in your mind, you live through it. And, you know, you remember all the 6 a.m. practices that he has, and you remember the pre-season training. We would run Cemetery Hill. We would run the track. We would just do everything. And but yes, 20 years, it is a long time, but it's phenomenal, man. And to be the first team, you know, to win the university its first national championship and then take the university to its first Final Four is special. And, you know, you'll never forget that, you know, to be in history is also a great feat. You know, no one can take our championship away. So it definitely is something special. And, you know, I'm happy that they're doing it, and I can't wait until the 24th.
Are you aware of your sort of cult status amongst UConn fans? I mean, I pointed out the 20 years to just emphasize that there are kids at UConn who probably were not alive for that game, who know who you are and revere you as like an iconic figure at UConn. I mean,
that's wow. That's great. And, you know, as a basketball player, you want your hard work to be appreciated. And I'm just so happy and so honored that they do remember me. And because I would never, ever forget the University of Connecticut, what the fans, the love that they showed me, the love that they gave me through good and bad. It was just a phenomenal relationship. And it feels good to come back home and you're remembered for, you know, not only just being a good basketball player, but, you know, for being a good teammate, for being a good person. And I think that's what's most important and what I hold near and dear to me.
One of my favorite moments, I think it was in 2014 when your whole 99 team came back and you got your name on the wall. But Shabazz Napier was on that team. And after the game, I was hanging out just waiting to go back to a press conference. And Shabazz's mom, Carmen, was there. And she was literally just standing at half court looking nervous. And I was like, what's up? And she's like, do you think I can ask Colin for a picture? And she said, you were her favorite player when you were at UConn. And I think helped influence Shabazz to come to UConn. I always just thought that was so cool that Shabazz's mom was like a huge fan. I think you did get her picture too, I think.
Yeah. You know, we hung out a little bit, especially at the Final Four, you know. Wow. What kind of run did Shabazz have? Got the opportunity to win 2 national championships. That's so crazy. That's unheard of. But yes, we had some time. We hung out. We took pictures. We talked. And yes, you know, I guess I've heard over the years that you know, from different recruits and, you know, different people around the university that, you know, they thought that I was the most important recruit that, that UConn had. And, you know, I love to hear things like that because, you know, I gave my everything, you know, each game and wanted to be the best player, to be the best teammate, and, of course, to win a championship. So, you know, it just feels good to have people, you know, respect your time and everything that you gave on the court and to the team.
Can you tell us your UConn origin story? How does a kid from Minnesota end up in Storrs, Connecticut?
Well, it's a wild story, but I figure we got time. So, okay, I'll start. I'll start from the beginning. But no, it happened, and it was crazy because in the beginning, you know, as a sophomore, I committed to the University of Minnesota. You know, I was a homeboy. I'm born and raised here in Minneapolis. I love the Gophers. You know, I'm a big student of the game, so I know the history of Minnesota and all the great teams that they had, the great coaches. So, yes, I wanted to be a part of that, being from a Minnesota boy. So having the opportunity to go out to the ABCD camp in it was in New Jersey my sophomore year. You know, it was a camp of the top 100 high school players. You had Kobe Bryant. You had Tim Thomas. You had all the great players. And I was a 10th grader, and, you know, the story that hasn't been told a lot is that Richard Hamilton and Kevin Freeman, they were on that team with me. We were on the same team at ABCD camp. What's the odds of that, right? So we're playing on the same team. Unfortunately, Kevin Freeman got hurt during that talent camp, that summer camp, and it was just me and Rip. So, you know, we had a phenomenal camp. I think he was rated maybe the fourth or fifth best player, and I was maybe the ninth best player in there. So we were both top 10. So long story short, I got a call from the New York City Gauchos. Their point guard got hurt during that tournament, and I had an opportunity to play with the Gauchos. And so, you know, we went out to Vegas, and, you know, I played well. And so, you know, I guess I was schools knew I was committed to Minnesota, so they didn't really, you know, say too much to me or whatnot. But that next summer when I went back, I had an opportunity to play with Lamar Odom and the Long Island Panthers. And he was being recruited heavily by everyone. You know, Lamar Odom, he was 6'9", left-handed. He was the high school Magic Johnson at that age. And he was being recruited by everyone, and Coach Hobbs was definitely trying to recruit him. And so seeing, you know, he was getting so much love by so many teams, I wanted, you know, some of that love. And I was got to thinking to myself, wow, is Minnesota really the place for me? And so I decided, you know, I wanted to take a couple of visits and see if that was the best decision. So that's what I did. I visited Kansas. I went to Georgetown and Connecticut, and I took an official visit to Minnesota. And when I went to Connecticut, I got to play with the guys, and it was just, it was a match, man. I watched them a few times on TV that previous season. They won the preseason NIT. Mm-hmm. And I just knew they needed a player like myself. And, you know, when I played with them, it just solidified everything. And after that pickup, after that day that I got to play with the guys, I knew that was going to be the place for me.
Now you're so sort of
that's how I ended up there.
You're sort of known for having a big personality, and we're even back in college. And obviously Jim Calhoun has a big personality. I mean, how often did you two sort of bump up against each other, and especially your freshman year?
I mean, I guess a couple of times, maybe we had some, you know, run-ins. Maybe I was talking in practice a couple of times while he was trying to talk, or
hey, now they pay you to talk.
And stuff like that. But it wasn't that many times. I know the legend is, you know, we just kept bumping heads, but it wasn't like that. I respected his title as head coach, and I knew, you know, he was the leader of the team. So, you know, occasionally we bumped heads, but it wasn't as many times as everyone thinks. I had to let him know a couple of times that, you know, I know I made a mistake, but I got this, and you don't have to yell. I got this. I'm going to make the right play the next time. So, you know, it was definitely a great relationship we had with each other.
You obviously, you mentioned the great times. Obviously the championship game is a lasting memory, but what are some of your other favorite either games or just moments from your time at UConn?
Yeah, I mean, it's so many, and I can't remember all, but just coming in as a freshman and reading up, of course, on the history of UConn, you know, and just knowing that it was a prestigious university even back then. You know, we had great players come through the program, and I just felt as if, you know, UConn deserved the Final Four. We deserve a national championship for everything that we've been through, the close losses in the Final Eights and all the games with Duke and just all the history that went into Connecticut. I felt like I wanted to get to a Final Four because of those history, those guys, the Tony Hansons, the Cliff
Robinson.
Robinson, of course, Ray Allen, you know, all even Coach Hobbs, even back to his day, you know.
Yeah.
So it was just, like I said, I really played to win. And I can just remember the practices that the instilled in us, you know, playing hard and wanting to win something. It was just something that I'll never forget. And it is helped me as a man, you know, and when I coach my boys and now that I'm entering coaching, I do a lot of the same things that Coach Calhoun instilled in me as far as, you know, having a sense of urgency and playing hard and being smart. So those are the things that stick out most and has stuck with me, you know, from my time at Connecticut.
I thought you were going to say jumping on the scorer's table.
Well, you know, that was my signature move. You know, I jump on the table because, you know, why not? You know, I mean, hitting the game winner is just so exciting, man. So thrilling. And, you know, I had a few of them in my career. So I always used to take that moment in and jump on the table for good times, you know.
Do you have a favorite moment? I saw one of you from high school pretty recently, and I've definitely seen one from the pros, and of course Pitt. Do you have like a favorite tabletop moment?
Let me see. I don't know if I have a favorite. I think each game winner, you know, was special in its own right because, you know, having the team on the brink of a loss, and then all of a sudden, you know, we hit the game winning shot. There's no other feeling like that. So they all are up there on the same pedestal. I like I said, I just been fortunate to have so many. And, you know, I kind of just I thought of myself as a clutch player. You know, anybody can, you know, start the game off hot or, you know, hit a lot of shots during the game, but in those last clutch moments, that's when you see the real players and the real superstars step up. And, you know, I prided myself on that.
Yeah. So, you know, thinking back to like the 99 tournament, that Elite Eight game against Gonzaga, you didn't have a good game for like the first 39 minutes or whatever. You hit those key free throws down the stretch. You hit those last two free throws with 5 seconds left in the championship game to extend that lead to three. What goes through your mind when you're stepping up to the line in what is potentially the biggest moment in basketball in the history of your school?
Yeah, and you're right. I didn't play. I didn't have my best offensive game that game. And you know, what a time to have a damn 0 for 13. I had to make it up. I had to do something for the team because, you know, I just felt like it, and it wasn't like, you know, I just had a horrible game and I was just turning the ball over, but, you know, I just wasn't offensively myself. So I just, you know, when you step up to the line, you just remind yourself, man, you shot thousands of free throws in your career. This is just another free throw. So relax and shoot it as if you're shooting it like you've done it multiple times before. And that's what I did. And, you know, I was able to knock them down and we escaped with the victory. And, you know, it's not about all the time, you know, having the great game, but winning the games that when you don't play well, that's the measure of a good player. And hopefully I was able to do that and show the fans that even though I wasn't scoring a lot, I was going to help the team in some way.
Khalid, during that 99 championship game, I feel like, you know, all through that tournament, everybody was, you know, it was Duke, it was Duke, it was Duke, it was Duke. And going into that game, you guys seemed like you were really confident in yourselves. And I always wondered sort of how much of that, like, Duke's the best commentary was, like, fueling you. Like, did you guys have, like, a chip on your shoulder going into that game? Oh,
definitely did. You know, back then, you know, you hear, you know, all of the, I guess, Duke was supposed to be a 10-point favorite. You know, and we were hearing that. And you know, Coach even said, you know, in our, the night before, in our, we watched video and we were getting prepared. And, you know, he told us that this is the only time he said that through my whole, you know, 3 years that I was there, that he said, this team is better than you, you know, and that really got the guy's attention. And I can remember that, you know, when he said that, I don't know if I just felt the focus in the room went from, it was already on 100, so it went to 200, and guys were really locked in. And, you know, I can remember that shoot around the next morning. Guys were so laser focused that we had to win that game, you know. And like you said, we went in with a chip on our shoulder, and we did it as a team. You know, Rip did have a great game. He had 27 points, but we did it as a team, because you can see that, you know, in the last moments, you know, I had a big bucket, but everybody played a key part at one time or another in that game.
It's probably the best game Ricky Moore ever played, too, on the biggest game of his life.
Everybody stepped up in key moments. That's what the beauty of the game was, because as you see, you know, and if you watch the game, you know, during late in the game, Duke looked a little bit, you know, tired, and we were still fresh and pushing the ball up the court. So we definitely won that game.
It's also probably the best coached game I've ever seen in my life.
and like I said it before, but coaches, he's an underrated. Yes, he's a Hall of Famer. Yes, he is. But he's underrated. You know, he should be mentioned up there with the top guys, because like you said, to manage the 10 guys we had, to manage them and get them in and at the right time and key time, yes, it was a masterpiece. And he deserves a little bit more respect than he gets.
Well, yeah, when we discuss it among ourselves, we say that Coach Calhoun is among the top three, and there's a credible argument to be made that he's the best college coach of all time based on what he did with what he had for resources.
I mean, like I said, I understood his, and because I'm a student of the game, you know, his upbringing and how he started with Northeastern, then came to UConn, and just built these powerhouses, man, right? And like you said, it was, it's appreciated, but it should be, he should get more pub than that. He should, yes, it should be, one of the courts should be Calhoun's court, and the other court should be Geno's court. I think it's time.
I'm into that.
Yeah, we'll start the petition.
Yeah, make that happen.
So, Kyle, then you came back for your junior year, and you guys were really good, but then you got hurt in the tournament. I mean, how brutal was that of a way to end your career at UConn?
Don't remind me. And it was just such a routine play that how I got hurt. And it was unfortunate, because we were going to make a nice run. We had a favorable side of the bracket. And we were going to, if we got past that game, we were going to make a run. But unfortunately, like you said, I just wasn't myself. And Tennessee was able to get us.
How difficult was that decision after that game to not return for your senior year?
It was difficult, you know. Being that, you know, you still want to play, you know, I had a lot of good friends on that team. But, you know, like I said before, it was just a business decision, and it was time. It was time for me to go experience what being a pro was all about.
Did you consider leaving after your sophomore year? I know it's crazy in 2019 to think back that guys of your caliber actually played 3 years in college.
But,
you know, yeah,
I just personally, maybe hindsight, you could have, but you know, I felt like I wanted to do one more year of college. You know,
you also seem to really just enjoy being there.
No, I did. It was, you know, it's college.
Right.
you definitely enjoyed it. And I enjoy all facets of, you know, I enjoy being a student athlete. You know, I enjoyed, you know, all of the practices, all of the games. I enjoyed all of that. And like I said, the things that I've learned in college from Coach Calhoun and the coaching staff really prepared me to become a professional, and I wouldn't trade that for the world.
I saw Rip say at some point that he would have stayed for his senior year if they paid, I forget what the exact amount was, but he was talking out in favor of paying college basketball players, and he was saying he didn't even really want to leave, but it was time for him to go make his money. And he was like, it really wouldn't have taken that much to get me to stay. I mean, I guess, first off, where do you sort of come down on if college players should be paid?
I mean, of course, I think, you know, college players, they could be given something, you know. It would help the college game now if they did. You know, you would have guys sticking around more than 1 year, you know, because, you know, they feel like they're not being paid, so they always have a risk of getting injured, so they have to leave. They have to go try to get the money when they can. So, you know, if you want the college game to get back to how it used to be with a, you know, with juniors and seniors on the team, you know what I mean? You have to. Times are different now. Let's just be realistic and let's move accordingly.
What are the biggest sort of differences that you see now calling college games that in ways the game on the court has changed versus when you actually played?
I think, you know, it's all about stretching the floor. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody wants that stretch four. Everybody wants that five man to be able to be versatile, can move, can shoot a little bit. So that's how the game has changed. You know, I was still in an era where, you know, the big man was utilized. We gave it to him on the low block. When we penetrated, we dropped it off to him. We allowed him to manufacture the points underneath the basket. And so I think that's just the big difference between then and now. And, you know, just all the major conference breakups, you know, it was just a shame that the Big East had to break up like it did. And yeah, so, I mean, it's just different, you know. Money is definitely a big part of it. And we understand that. And you have to, like I said, you have to adjust accordingly.
Have you gotten a chance to watch this year's UConn team at all? I know you did halftime for one of the games, right?
Oh, yeah. I watched a few games, actually. You know, damn near almost all of them. I mean, yeah. Right? I mean, it's my alma mater, you know, and mm-hmm. I really enjoy seeing the guys play. And I just really think they need that inside presence. You know, I think they are relying too much on the perimeter to do the majority of the scoring. And that's a lot of pressure on those guys to score every single night in and night out, to have their shot on. They need the opportunity to throw it inside, take a couple possessions, you know, and manufacture easy points. So I think they're getting around to it. And, you know, I'm sure they're going to recruit to that. So, you know, the future's going to be bright, but I like the way things are going now. And so that's my take.
So I think we would all agree that the team needs more of an interior presence right now. But given the personnel that the team has and, you know, coming from your standpoint as a guard, what sort of advice would you give to a guard on this UConn team, try to get the most out of this season?
Well, I mean, continue competing, you know, and I think when we're in those close games and we're right there, I think a lot of times, you know, we have to know where we want to go with the ball. What's our mismatches? How are we going to play in different situations? And, you know, as of right now, I just, that would be my what I would say to them. You know, we have to get the best shot possible. You know, a lot of times, you know, we're just playing on the feel of the game, and we got to just be a little bit more methodical on where the ball is going to go, who has the hot hand, and let's run sets for that guy. You know what I mean? So, but it's a process, and I understand Coach Hurley and the coaching staff is doing the best that they can. But for me, on the outside looking in, I would like to see just a little bit more of a structure and setting guys up, setting more screens for guys to get them open for opportunities to score.
Like a double screen on the baseline that leads to open 17-foot jump shot. Yeah. Like we saw you take 900 times in 3 years.
Yes. And we say that jokingly, but those plays work, and those give opportunities for those type of players that we have right now. That gives them opportunities to score. You know what I mean? We have shooters. We have guys that can play off the screen. So we have to try to utilize that. And there's nothing wrong with you know, being the transition team and trying to manufacture easy buckets. But sometimes you're going to have to play half court ball. And that's how you win, playing half court ball, setting those screens, and because we don't have the inside presence. So let's get these guys open off, you know, off those rapture cuts, off those zip cuts, off those baseline screens, and give these guys more opportunity to turn the corner.
Do big guys know how to set screens these days? I feel like you played with Jake Vosko, who was, I don't know, in our mind at least, one of the best screeners that I've ever seen in the front court.
That's what we have to be working on in practice. You know, hey, you big guys, I mean, we're going to be honest, you're not the best interior scorer. So what else can we do to get better? What else can we do to put you in a position to make us better? And I think setting good screens and learning how for them to set good screens would benefit us, you know?
You sure you don't want to coach at the college level?
Yeah, this sounded good.
I'm making my way that way, you know, and, you know, I would love to come back and or coach at the collegiate level, you know, but it's going to work itself out. It's going to be in due time. Right now, I'm enjoying being an analyst for Inside College Basketball and coaching my high school team. But, you know, anything can happen in the future.
What's your schedule like as an analyst? Do you have to go to New York on the weekends? I mean, how does
not only on the weekends, it's during the week too. So yes, mm-hmm. I fly out to New York and do however many shows and fly back to Minneapolis and get back to my usual routine. So it's not as hectic, but you know, it is a lot of travel, and I just try to be, you know, as prepared, you know, and as long as I keep everything on my schedule, I will be okay.
Can we expect to see you during March on CBS at all?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be there. I'm going to work through the Final Four, so you're going to see me a lot. And hopefully, you know, I do good enough job so they can ask me back.
Well, we're stoked.
Yeah, I think you'll be just fine. All right, well, Kyle, we'll let you go, man. But thank you so much for taking the time. It was great to catch up with you and hear some of your memories and what you're up to now. And get your A-plus analysis that we can look forward to on the sideline someday.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me, man. And anytime you need me, just reach out. You know, I bleed blue, so we can. Are you guys coming to the Final Four? Because if you are, reach out to me, man. I got to. You know, I know all the right spots.
Now we are.
Good. Sounds good. But like I said, thank you for having me, and I can't wait to do it again.
All right, bro. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Dimebag Podcast. This will be the last ever episode because we'll never top that interview. But until next time, we'll talk to you.